From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll tell you about an exhibit that celebrates the many groundbreaking things the Milwaukee Public Museum has done over its long history.
One thing I actually found out towards the end of making this exhibit is that our T-Rex diorama was the world's first full-sized dinosaur diorama within its actual natural habitat.
We'll examine some artifacts left over from Milwaukee's past mental health care facilities, plus learn what the iconic Wisconsin Gas building is made of.
This is the oldest thing you'll ever touch in your entire life. And from the standpoint of the stone, you are this extremely fleeting, ephemeral creature that's just zipping by very quickly.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. In downtown Milwaukee, not far from the Pfizer Forum, you can see construction underway at the corner of 6th and McKinley. That will eventually be the new home of the Milwaukee Public Museum. While the museum is still in the process of packing up millions of items to move to a new location, there's an exhibit that invites guests to learn about MPM's past, present, and future. It's called Groundbreaking, the Evolution of a Natural History Museum, and it highlights how MPM set the standard for natural history museums. It also helps guests understand why the museum is moving and what is happening to all of the artifacts. Amanda Kopp is MPM's Collections Interpretation Manager. WUWM's Eddie Morales visited the museum to speak with Kopp about the exhibit.
Our groundbreaking exhibit covers over 142 years of the Milwaukee Public Museum's history, from its roots as the German-English Academy all the way through to our future building, which is set to open in 2027.
Where did the idea for this start? And I feel like groundbreaking has a couple of different meanings here in the title for the exhibit, if you could speak to that as well.
The idea came really almost 9 years ago when I started here, and I started learning all these little interesting tidbits from different people about the history of MPM, a lot of world's first, country's first. And I thought, this information is so interesting, but, you know, who would really be interested in learning about it? But when we announced the new museum being built, a lot of people started showing their interest in the history of MPM. So I and actually another staff member at the same time proposed this idea of creating an exhibit about the history of MPM. And you are right about groundbreaking as a sort of double meaning. We have broken ground as a museum that's influenced museums around the world many times, but also obviously we've just broken ground on our new site.
Can you kind of explain to me, when people first walk in, what is it they're seeing, what they can expect to see as they're walking through, just kind of generally?
Sure. So our exhibit's set up into three parts, and the first section is everything before this building, the building that we're currently in. So this covers 1963 backwards. And this area I was really trying to answer through the history of MPM, also the question of what does a museum do? So through our natural collections, our cultural collections, our education department, and of course our exhibits, which is what most people are familiar with a museum.
And is there anything from this first section that you sort of want to highlight, something that maybe we can read a little bit about or describe some of the items?
So these are two old mannequins. One thing I tried to really do is, I know people grew up here and spent a lot of time here, so there's a lot of nostalgia with this building. So I actually wanted to bring some of that out. On the external wall to this exhibit, you'll see pictures from this building, but in the past, from like the 60s and 70s and 80s. But one thing I remembered strongly as a child was coming to our old Ancient Worlds exhibit called Temples, Tales, and Tombs and seeing Cleopatra laid out on her couch. And that is the first time I remember having like an exhibit having an impact on me. And for many years, I was then obsessed with the ancient world. And when our exhibit artist, Nancy, told me that Cleopatra was still in our storage, I said, she has to come out for this exhibit. So Cleopatra's here. It's great to see her again after probably 20-some years.
You touched on a little bit of this museum being groundbreaking in several ways, like world's first and nation's first. If there's anything that kind of applies to that as we walk around, I think that'd be pretty cool to just highlight some of those specific examples.
One of our most famous ones, I would say, is the streets of Old Milwaukee. It was the world's first like immersive exhibit, I always call it that you could suddenly enter the diorama. And so that immersive exhibit style is found really everywhere nowadays, but the Streets of Old Milwaukee was one of the first ones that allowed you to go inside the diorama and be a part of that experience. The Bison Hunt was the world's largest open-air diorama. Tribute was the first exhibit in the country to be made with, not just about, Native peoples. One thing I actually found out towards the end of making this exhibit is that our T-Rex diorama was the world's first full-sized dinosaur diorama within its actual natural habitat. One of the biggest impacts we've had is on the diorama itself. So the Muskrat diorama here at MPM was made by a man named Carl Akeley. And so he wanted to show how it lived in its natural environment rather than just kind of putting it on a pedestal on all four legs looking very stiff and unlifelike. And so he created that actually as a tester to show to the board to make a whole series of these. Eventually he left MPM, so he didn't make too many more here. He did make them in other institutions, but that one right there created the Milwaukee style of exhibitry, which is that lifelike, moment paused in time style of exhibiting.
Something that came to mind though is with, you know, mentioning the world's first and nations first, and with Milwaukee being behind so much of that, what is it about Milwaukee and like preserving history here and the people behind it?
Well, one thing I can say that a lot of people don't know is we're actually one of the first five or six natural history museums in the country. So we had a very early start in the museum field here in the United States. So I think that partially contributed to that impact that we had. Another thing is just really innovative and progressive directors that we had who really were always pushing the envelope, trying to think of new ways to do things and finding new and exciting ways to bring the history of the world and the cultures of the world to Milwaukee.
Being one of the world's first museums to co-create a Native American exhibit with tribal members, can you just kind of elaborate on this today and also where it came from a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, the history of museums and Native Americans obviously has been tenuous in the past. For a while it was, you know, a lot of that relationship was just archaeologists going and doing scientific research and taking items and then putting it on display without any consultation. I did find out that MPM, even in the 1916, was bringing in consultants from the Native American community, which I think is great, but there was still obviously a lot of work to be done. Today, one artifact I have on display is a large corn basket. It was made by a woman named Leandra Skenendor, and she made it specifically for MPM. And she talked with our education director, told her the purpose of it, and then gave her permission for us to use this object. So I put her baskets on display because that really highlights the change in relationship with Native Americans and the museum. And that is really continuing forward with the future museum. So in 2022, we hired our manager of tribal relations, James Flores, and a key part of his role here has been working with Wisconsin's 12 Native American communities to build out their stories that are going to be displayed at the future museum. So they've been involved from the beginning on saying, these are the objects that highlight our lives and our stories and our culture. This is how it should be told. And also being very receptive to when they ask for something not to be on display. And it's not just Native Americans, but throughout the world is being built from the ground up with the voices of origin communities involved.
What are some reasons, if you can speak to this, why a certain artifact might not be displayed based on a request?
So sometimes it is a ceremonial use that really should never have been out in the public in the first place. And sometimes we just, with working with these community groups, we think something that's a very simple object, like a fish hook, is not just a simple object. We had a group looking at some of our items recently, and fish hooks actually in that culture were passed down from father to son to grandson, and so they actually have a very strong community connection, and we just had it on display as a fish hook, and they, you know, informed us that it really isn't appropriate to display that way, and so it was taken down. One thing that we plan to include in the future museum is a tribal visit room, and what that means is a place where anybody from an origin community can see their items that we have in our collections in a respectful, nice place, reconnect with the things made by their ancestors. Some items actually need to be cared for. Some items in certain cultures, for example, are fed. And having this tribal visit room will give them the space and privacy that they can do those things and care for those objects in a cultural way while we care for them in that sort of, you know, humidity and all those other sort of ways.
So this case is all about accessibility and the work that we have done at MPM to make all of our things as accessible as possible for the visually impaired, for people who might have sensory processing issues, anything we can to make the museum more friendly and a place that everyone feels welcome. We try to do that. In addition to that, a really interesting fact I discovered while doing this exhibit was that when the museum was looking for visitor services people in 1892, they actually required that those people could speak conversationally in English and German because there was such a high level of German speakers in Milwaukee. And today, rather than German, we have a high level of Spanish speakers in the community. So MPM is doing a lot to present as much information as we can, both in English and Spanish. This exhibit, Groundbreaking, will have Spanish translations available both in your hand, in a binder, as well as through QR codes throughout.
So walking through and now coming to the end of the exhibit, can you tell me a little bit about the messages on the walls here, what you kind of want guests to come away with after having seen everything that we've walked through?
I kind of wanted to answer two of the main questions people have. Why are we moving and what's happening to our stuff? As I mentioned earlier, we're moving for a lot of the same reasons we moved in 1964. This building is no longer really a safe place for our collections or our exhibits, but it's more than just safety. It's also just a building that is not in line with current accessibility standards. We have really uneven floors, which were a design choice at the time. Unfortunately, there's not great lighting. The elevators are very difficult for people with strollers or in wheelchairs to get into, and a lot of just deterioration in the public-facing side of it that is making it difficult to serve people and get them excited about the world today. And then in terms of what's happening to our current exhibits, I wanted to first clarify that collections and exhibits are different. Collections are the things that we own, specifically that were collected for scientific research. And we have about 4 million objects and specimens that we care for, and those are all coming with us. To the Future Museum, we aren't getting rid of anything that is part of our collections. For our exhibits, they are more the components, those the things that make up the dioramas that we see. And we are planning to bring many of them with us, actually. We have Samson, the Howler Monkey, and Granny, all those different things were definitely coming with us. But smaller components, we had to talk about how many of the trees from Tribute to Survival are going to be coming with us. So we are bringing many of those components with. The ones that we don't, we are hoping can find homes in new institutions and continue to educate in new places.
Amanda Kopp is the Collections Interpretation Manager at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales last fall. You've got just a few more days to check out the exhibit at the museum, as it ends on January 20th. The history of the Behavioral Health Division and mental health care in the Milwaukee area can be traced back to the 1850s. Over the decades, many facilities have been built to address the mental health needs of the community, and those buildings and the artifacts left behind help tell our history of mental health care. Jonathan Peel is the unofficial historian for the BHD. He joins me to share some of the history we can still see today, starting with the County Grounds Park.
County Grounds Park is 112 acres, and it includes 60 acres of woods, and that contains some of the remnants that are still there today, notably of the landscaping, but this was patient-curated landscaping and other artifacts. So in ways, it's an outdoor museum that people can still visit today.
Yeah, I love the fact that outdoors can be an artifact, too.
Yes.
Within the grounds, there is one particular artifact we're going to talk about. It's a dolphin urn.
That is correct. Yeah, the dolphin urn is actually quite famous. It's been cataloged by the Smithsonian American Arts Museum's Inventories of American Paintings and Sculpture database, and yet it's just sitting out in the open for anybody to be able to see. This particular piece is actually being cared for by the Ronald McDonald House, and I appreciate their contribution to both giving it a location and keeping it safe here over 110 years. So this particular sculpture can be found just south of the park in the Ronald McDonald parking lot, that Ronald McDonald House being on Watertown Plank Road. And this is a 6-foot-tall stone vase, often referred to as a dolphin urn. So we can find records that in 1908, there was a patient admitted by the name of Vladimir Jonathan Kosarek. He was going through mental health issues, but he also had a background as a stonecutter. And as part of his industrial therapy, he wanted to carve a large vase to help beautify the grounds. And so the administration of the hospital contacted his employer, which was a quarry, and that employer provided an uncut piece of Bedford stone, 6 feet tall, about 3 feet in each other direction. And he had carved then this beautiful 6-foot vase in just a few months. He did it without a model. It included ornamental dolphins, part of the vase being the urn. And then coming out of the mouth of each dolphin is a little frog. Coming out of the mouth of each frog is some garland. Each of the four sides of the vase, the garland represents a different season. And so you can go to that Ronald McDonald House parking lot, again, just a few hundred feet south of the park, and be able to look at that. There's still an inscription of 1908 on it. There's still an inscription with V.J. Kosarek, really the name initials of the artist who was a patient and was able to be there, be able to improve his mental health state, to be able to be released and leave something of beauty to really inspire other patients for more than 100 years.
Really a great thing to have something still physically there that we can visit. And along those lines, there are remnants. It's not quite what it looked like before. But up next, we have the Sunken Garden.
Yep. The Sunken Gardens included a 1.5-acre lake, several waterfalls, beautiful walkways, a cement pergola, and then tiered gardens. And as part of industrial therapies, many of these features were created by patients, and certainly the gardens were curated by patients. What still remains today are portions of two waterfalls, a little of the cement porches, and the tiered landscape. Over 50 years, this area became really overgrown with invasive plants and buckthorn. And over the last 2 years, the Friends of County Grounds Park organization has been clearing that buckthorn and opening the land up. This effort has included the contributions of dozens of local high school students helping to remove that buckthorn. And this past year, several students were inspired to plant wildflower seeds at that same location of the historic gardens. Despite the pandemic, they executed a bake sale at high school basketball games and raised enough funds to plant thousands of native wildflower seeds just this past spring. We expect those native wildflowers to start blooming this coming spring, changing the historic Sunken Gardens back to a current Sunken Gardens. Again, viewable by anyone who enjoys the park.
Definitely. So speaking of forests, there is a women's grove that was once a recreational area for patients, right?
That is correct. Part of the improvements in mental health care over several decades was simply separating men and women from each other in the care of mental health issues. And so that included that the buildings had a men's wing and a women's wing. And this recreational area that included a forest had a men's grove and a women's grove. Within the women's grove, there was a large natural ravine. And in the early 1900s, patients built two field stone staircases for accessing each part of the ravine. Down the middle of the ravine, there was a small creek and footbridges. Today, the historic stairs still exist. While there has been a lot of decay, they've been sufficiently cleared for safe passage. It's really a hidden gem within the park. It still provides a sanctuary for visitors today, just as it did 100 years ago. In fact, the woods surrounding those stairs are called Sanctuary Woods.
You mentioned there was a separation of men and women for both treatment and recreation, but there is one other artifact we're going to talk about today, and that's the patient picnic video, and this is about the 1940s and 50s that this was captured?
Yep, that is correct. And so, as we mentioned before, while there was separation under most circumstances, there were times and places where patients were encouraged to interact, and each year there was an enormous all-patient picnic on the grounds. There has been some 16-millimeter film that captured these picnics and provided a wonderful insight into how the patients enjoyed manicured grounds 80 years ago. The picnics had temporary tenting for dining areas, temporary grandstands for viewing the festivities. On the perimeter were rows for carnival games like ring toss and other small competitions like pie eating contests. In the middle were various all-day long activities like baseball games, teams for three-legged races, teams for human wheelbarrow races. All day long, there was a live band and opportunities for dancing. It's refreshing to see the pure joy of everyone involved and a wonderful representation of how patients' time at the hospital weren't limited to the conventional image of incarceration. They got to be outside. They got to interact. There was joy in their lives and in their day, and also captured in those videos.
Well, and if people are interested, they can go to the County Grounds Parks to see some of the things that still remain today and bring some joy into people's lives as well. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing more. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Jonathan Peel is the unofficial historian of the Behavioral Health Division here in Milwaukee. We spoke in 2023. To see photos of the artifacts that we talked about, head on over to WUWM.com. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 20 minutes, we'll help you plan a trip to Eagle River for this month's Wandering Wisconsin. But first, the gas building in Milwaukee is made of one of the oldest materials on Earth. We'll tell you all about it in our series, What Milwaukee is Made Of, coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Wisconsin Gas Building may be best known for what is on top, a flame-shaped lamp that changes color with the weather. But it's also one of Milwaukee's foremost contributions to the Art Deco era, and its story begins over 3 billion years ago when its building materials were beginning to form. Raymond Wiggers is a geologist and author of Milwaukee in Stone and Clay. He joins Lake Effect Sam Woods to discuss the architectural geology of the gas building for the latest episode of What Milwaukee is Made Of.
We'll start with the gas building's lower exterior. It's made of Morton gneiss, a stone with black, white, and pink colors. But Ray, when and where did this stone begin to form?
Well, it began to form so far back in geologic time that it's almost hard to imagine what we're talking about. This is a rock, first of all, that's known as a migmatite. And the oldest portion of that rock dates to about 3.524 billion years ago. It's one thing to talk about these big numbers, like 3.524 billion years ago, but it's quite another to actually have people understand that. And one of the things I do is when I've done tours wherever there's a building with Morton gneiss, I always have the participants go up and touch the stone and say, look, this is the oldest thing you'll ever touch in your entire life. And from the standpoint of the stone, you are this extremely fleeting, ephemeral creature that's just zipping by very quickly. I mean, this is literally about one quarter to one third the age of the entire universe. This is how old this rock is. It's something that is by far the oldest thing you'll ever touch. In fact, the Morton gneiss or the Morton migmatite is one of the oldest surviving rocks on the surface of the earth. There are a few rocks in northern Canada and also over in Western Australia that are older, but the Morton gneiss is the oldest rock used for any kind of architectural application. So as far as building stone, this is the oldest building stone on earth.
So take us back to this time. What was the Earth like 3.5 billion years ago?
Well, of course, when you go back that far in Earth history, the evidence becomes very attenuated and vague. But as far as we can tell, this is a time before the rise of multicellular life. So the only kinds of life forms you would have found on the early Earth at this point probably would have been unicellular organisms, especially bacteria and archaea, things like that. So the surface of the Earth on the continents, such as they were at the time, there wasn't apparently a lot of continental material at that point, but what there was, the dry land, was actually quite barren and rocky looking. So if you can imagine going to a place where there's, you know, recently been a volcanic eruption on Earth, maybe in Hawaii, and you have a lot of expanse of volcanic rock or igneous rock, that's the way probably the surface looked at that point. As far as what the world was like, the Earth was spinning faster. the moon was certainly in the sky. In fact, it was about twice as close as it is now. And the gravitational effect of the moon pulling on the Earth's oceans would have created colossal tides. Also, the atmosphere had no breathable oxygen. It had no free oxygen at that point, we're quite sure. So it would have been a very, very inimical place for people to visit. In fact, if you were able to jump into a time machine and go back to the Paleo-Archean era, which is that first portion of the Morton Ice when it formed, you'd have to wear some kind of a survival suit just to survive.
So take me through the billion years or so that it took for this rock to completely form. And I mentioned Morton Ice's combination of colors. How did this rock form with such an array of different colors, those blacks, those whites, those pinks?
Well, first of all, let me point out where this rock comes from. So it is, to this day, it's still quarried in a little town called Morton, Minnesota. It's in southwestern Minnesota. And that chunk of real estate to a geologist is fascinating because it's part of what's known as the Minnesota River Valley terrain. The quarry is right near the Minnesota River. And that chunk of continental crust actually began somewhere else besides what was then North America. And it took over a billion years to actually collide with what became North America to become part of it. So it began in a very enigmatic chunk of early Earth's crust that began we know not where. But what was happening at that point is the first constituent was probably granite or a granite-like rock that became metamorphosed, probably through some kind of mountain building activity or compression of the Earth's crust, and it turned into this first form of gneiss. In fact, there was also another old rock that may even be older as far as we know. It hasn't been dated yet. It's a very black rock. And if you ever see the Morton Ice on the side of the Wisconsin Gas Building, you'll see that there are these big chunks of black rock. That is called amphibolite. And that rock is very, very, very old too. And so that may have fallen into the granitic magma. We don't know exactly when and where that formed. But then afterwards, there were other big tectonic events that introduced more magma that became granite and then became gneiss in turn. And so you have all these different swirling chaotic patterns of different colors based on the rock's composition.
So now moving on to the main entrance, there is a striking sunburst figure that catches my eye when I look at this building. But Ray, what's it made of?
Well, that beautiful Art Deco sunburst is actually made of bronze, which is a very venerable alloy that's been in continuous human use for at least 7,000 years. And bronze is actually what it is. It's a mixture of copper and tin, and sometimes other elements like antimony as well. But usually it's copper and tin is the base, you know, alloy mix there. And that is a geologically derived material just as much as the Morton Ice in its own way is. Why? Where do our metals come from that we use in architecture and everything else? They come from rocks. They come from ores. Ore is a mineral that is actually contained in a rock, which has some kind of economic potential to it. And so what we have is the main ores of copper that we have are two called malachite and chalcopyrite, and they're quarried in various parts of the world today. Tin is a somewhat rarer quantity. It comes from cassiterite, which is a mineral probably a lot of people haven't heard of, but you have to actually refine the metals, the elemental metals out of that ore, get rid of the impurities, and then blend them together to create this beautiful sort of golden metal.
And so how old is the sunburst figure that I'm looking at in the main entrance today? Has that been there since the beginning of the building?
Ooh, that's a good question. Actually, it was the original version of it was removed in 1966 during what I consider to be a widespread era of misguided renovations of famous architectural masterpieces like Wisconsin Gas Building. And later on, in fact, in 2003, a new version of the sunburst, it was a complete replica of the first, was installed to return that entrance to its former glory.
And now, if you tilt your head upward toward the upper exterior of the building, you'll find another pinkish yellow stone. What is this and when did it form?
Right. And this is the other stone component of the exterior of Wisconsin Gas, and it's used primarily for ornamental trim. Architects and builders know it as Kasota stone. It's very striking because it has kind of that pinkish yellow or pinkish golden color. It's a very strange, but really beautiful color. And it was used for ornamental trim around the rest of the material. Geologists actually know Kasota stone as the Oneota dolostone, and it dates to the lower Ordovician period. Okay, so once again, what does that mean? Well, it means it's about, 470 million years old, something like that. And it's a lot younger than the Morton gneiss, which goes back not millions, but billions of years. But it's still pretty ancient by human standards.
What was the environment like where this stone was forming 470 million years ago?
Well, at that point, the ancient version of North America, and particularly the American Midwest, had, once again, as it often did in those days, it had a shallow sea, saltwater sea, that was actually covering part of the continent. And so this is rock that formed in the shallow water of that sea.
So architecture enthusiasts may recognize the Wisconsin Gas Building as one of Milwaukee's biggest contributions to Art Deco, an architectural style popular in the first half of the 20th century. Ray, why did this architectural style rise in popularity during that time?
Ooh, that's a wonderful question. First of all, it followed a number of other architectural styles that were popular in the United States at that time. But one of its precursors was a style known as Art Nouveau, or the New Art. And it was a beautiful, beautiful style. You see it on some buildings in the Midwest that actually was based on stylized natural forms like tree stems and leaves and tendrils and things like that. Art Deco was somewhat of a reaction to that. And it had the same elegant approach and streamlined approach. But this time, what you're dealing with is this is the art form of the machine age. And it's, you know, it was a style that you saw in grand works of architecture, like some of the great architectural masterpieces, the great skyscrapers of America, all the way down to cars and kitchen toasters, you know, were in this Art Deco style. And it featured very streamlined forms, rectilinear forms or straight forms, but very stylishly done, and not much reference to nature. Rather, it's the machine age style. And in skyscrapers like the Wisconsin Gas Building, what you often will get, I call it the Daily Planet look, if you're familiar with Superman mythology. What you have is a building that is pretty chunky and wide down at the bottom that comes out to the street. But as it gets taller, it gets narrower in these different sections that get narrower. And this is called the setbacks. It has a series of setbacks that makes it look very, well, very streamlined and elegant.
Well, I see what you mean about these setbacks being a reflection of the machine age, because they look perfectly, like each one was cut perfectly and placed on top of each other, narrower and narrower to this point at the top. But can you give me an idea of what other buildings worldwide exhibit this style?
Oh, some of the most famous skyscrapers in America. Let's start with Milwaukee. The two other great Art Deco skyscrapers in Milwaukee are the Warner Building, now the home of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, and also Wisconsin Tower, a little bit farther down on Wisconsin Avenue heading west, which also, by the way, has lots of Morton gneiss on it, which is really neat to look at. And all three of these have setbacks.
So you mentioned Art Deco was a reaction to Art Nouveau. Was there a reaction that came after Art Deco that pushed it out of favor?
It was actually kind of an evolution into a related style before it went out of favor completely. And that successor style to Art Deco is known as Art Moderne. And sometimes it's hard to actually tell what's Art Deco and what's Art Moderne. In fact, you could even say Wisconsin Gas is Art Moderne partly. Art Moderne started coming in the 1930s in particular. Art Deco is more 1920s. And Art Moderne is just a more stylized, abstract version of Art Deco. Art Deco often had very beautiful, elaborate ornamentation, whereas Art Moderne tends to be more geometric and abstract.
Well, you mentioned in your book, Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, that one of the building materials at the Wisconsin Gas Building was not recorded. So I was curious, how often is this the case, that a building material is not recorded? And is there any way to determine an answer after the fact, or is that just a secret that's lost to time?
Well, let's put it this way. First of all, there are a lot of buildings that you have provenance or you have actual identification for some of the materials, but not all the materials. And that's extremely common. And you will see this on other like technical reports of architectural geology that are done for other cities in Europe and the United States. The archaeologist will be able to identify part of the materials, but not all of them. And so what you do is you talk more generally about the stuff that you can't really have good provenance on. In the case of Wisconsin Gas Building, the thing that's not well provenanced is the brick. So it's a fairly common thing. With brick in particular, often the source of the brick that's used, the beautiful ochre-colored brick that forms much of the upper stories of the building. At the time, probably the architect said, here's the color I want, this is this texture, or maybe I want tapestry brick or some other kind of special brick. And then the contractor just gets it from wherever he or she can. And then no one really worries about recording where it was obtained from, which of course frustrates the heck out of geologists like me.
Yeah, I bet. All right, well, Ray, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect once again, and I appreciate your time.
It's been wonderful. Thanks, Sam.
That was Raymond Wiggers, author of Milwaukee in Stone and Clay, a book about the architectural geology of Milwaukee buildings. He spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. Eagle River, Wisconsin is known as the snowmobile capital of the world. We'll help you plan a trip and tell you why snowmobiling is such a big deal there, next on Lake Effect on WUWM.
I have no need of friendship. Friendship causes pain. It's laughter and it's loving I disdain.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Temperatures may be below zero, but that doesn't mean you need to stay inside. There are lots of outdoor winter activities to explore in Wisconsin, like snowshoeing and cross-country skiing. For this month's Wandering Wisconsin, we'll tell you about a way you can enjoy one of our state's most popular winter activities, snowmobiling. WUWM's Becky Mortensen is joined by Amanda Weibel with Travel Wisconsin and Tom Anderson, the CEO of the World Championship Derby Complex in Eagle River. He shares about the upcoming snowmobile derby and why Eagle River is a great place for snowmobile enthusiasts to visit this January.
Tom and Amanda, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for joining me for our first Wandering Wisconsin of 2025.
Glad to be here.
Okay, same here.
To start, Tom, how would you describe the World Championship Snowmobile Derby to someone who has never been to it or maybe has never seen any kind of winter sport competition?
Well, if they're familiar with any kind of racing and they're familiar with the Indianapolis 500 that happens every spring, that Indy 500 is known as the epitome and the top race of the auto industry. The same applies to the Derby. It is known as the top race in the snowmobile racing era. If you win at Eagle River, it's akin to winning the Indy 500 championship.
What can people expect to see and experience if they come to the Derby?
World-class professional snowmobile racing. These are the top racers. They have to qualify to get to Eagle River. They go through a long series of elimination heats. It's a four-day event, culminating in a world championship on Sunday. However, there are 40 some different classes that they race snowmobiles on, different size engines, different size suspensions, and different things of that nature. But the big race is on Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, where we crown the, this year will be the 62nd world champion. This is the epitome. These are the big guys. This is the most professional snowmobile racing that exists in the country.
And I'm from the Midwest, so I know that snowmobiling is a very popular winter sport, but I didn't realize how big of a deal it is in Eagle River. They're actually known as the snowmobile capital of the world. So why is that?
Well, that connotation, Amanda, came across from the Derby race, of course, being the World Championship Derby race. It is the largest winter sports activity in northern Wisconsin. during the winter time. Eagle River is a big tourism town in the summer, but in the winter time, it all boils down to the Derby. The Derby is the big tourism attraction. Also, there are over 450 miles of professionally groomed snowmobile trails in and around the Eagle River area, the Vilas and Oneida County area. This is a tourism town, and it's based on tourism. There are plenty of motels, hotels, resorts. Many are open in the winter to service the snowmobile and cross-country skiing tourism. So Eagle River was a natural to have the World Championship Derby there, and a natural then to become the snowmobile capital of the world.
And the first snowmobile was invented not far from Eagle River. Can you share the history of the first motor toboggan?
That was by a gentleman named Carl Ellison, who unfortunately was born with what we call a club foot. Carl was an outdoor guy, loves to get out, hunt, walk in the woods, which was not much of a problem in the summertime for him. But come winter in the deep snows, he could not handle snowshoes or the deep snow. However, his father had a hardware store in the town of Saner, about 15 miles east or west, rather, of Eagle River. And Carl was an inventive type person. He liked to work things with his hands. He took a old toboggan frame, cut it down in the middle, mounted a outboard motor at that time, from outboard motors on the front of it, adapted that to a chain drive system, cooled it by a radiator from an old Model T Ford, put skis on the front of it with a rope to turn them, and the thing worked. He was able to go through the snow, 8-10 miles an hour, deep snow. It floated all over in the snow, and Carl was able to go. Well, people saw the first one he made, and well, I want to buy one. The second one was even better, the third, the fourth, the fifth, and within about 2 or 3 years, he had a crew of 4 or 5 people building snowmobiles. Pretty soon, within about 10 or 12 years, Sweden ordered 50 snowmobiles for their military in the country of Sweden. Carl couldn't produce 50 of them. He didn't have the manpower or the facility to do it. So he licensed the production to a company in Chilton, Wisconsin, who went on to build the snowmobile. From there, the snowmobile just developed. More companies took over the design, made better designs, and that's how the snowmobile developed. We celebrated a 100th anniversary here last year, from 1924 to 2024, of the invention of the first snowmobile. It was crude, but it worked. It worked very well.
That's amazing. And I understand at the Derby Complex, people can immerse themselves even further in the history of snowmobiling at the World Snowmobile Headquarters. What could people see and learn there?
The World Snowmobile Headquarters is a headquarters of about 5 different snowmobile groups all in one. These groups don't have a normal facility, but now we have one in the headquarters. It's home to the International Snowmobile Hall of Fame that honors I think it's 121 people, inventors, designers, trail builders, club organizations, people involved in the consumer end of building the snowmobile program. A lot of these people are never known to anywhere except their local communities, but they are the root of the snowmobile program. They are the developers that made the trails. Then we have the Derby history, a lot of photos of the Derby history. There are 70-some antique and vintage snowmobiles on display, some very unique. Many times the visitors will look at them and say, oh, I wish I had that one. That was my first one. I remember it. So there's a lot of nostalgia in the World Snowmobile Headquarters. A lot of displays of clothing, displays of snowmobile racing championship sleds. It's quite an experience to go through the museum. It's not just a stuffy old museum. It's a very nice put-together program.
And as you mentioned, Tom, Eagle River is it's a beautiful part of the state, popular with tourism, but it's January and it's cold. So what are some other things people could do inside to warm up after the Derby?
Oh, after the Derby? It's outside a little bit, yeah, but the ice castle is built by the fire department every year. It's probably a 30-foot-high ice castle made out of ice blocks cut from a local lake. Very gorgeous light inside with very colorful lighting. And every once in a while, you can see a frozen fish in the ice block. But the Ice Block Castle is great for photography for people. Skating rink. We have a light show at the park. The Children's Museum is great to look at. Many, many interactive displays are at the Children's Museum. And of course, we have, because it's a tourism town, plenty of restaurants, great food, all different kinds of variety of food. And so there's a lot to do after the races in the city of Eagle River.
Thanks, Tom. And same question for you, Amanda. What would you recommend people check out while they're in Eagle River?
I also recommend checking out that Northwoods Children's Museum. It's a great place to warm up if you're traveling with kids. They have 26 different hands-on exhibits. Some of the most popular include, they have a fishing pond, they have an art studio, and an old-time grocery store. So it's going to be fun for the kids, but honestly, parents, you're going to have a lot of fun too. If you're looking for more of that snowmobile history beyond the opportunities that Tom already mentioned, you can also visit the Snowmobile Hall of Fame in St. Germain. And that museum features an ever-changing display of historic sleds. And these snowmobiles are used for everything from track and drag racing to watercross and hill climbing. And like I said, they're always changing their display. So even if you've been in the past, you're going to want to go back and check out what they have now. And then, of course, you know, you're in the snowmobile capital of the world. Maybe you want to spend some more time enjoying the outdoors and go on your own snowmobile adventure. So Trackside is one of the local businesses that actually rent snowmobiles. They're really conveniently located right on the trail system for easy access whenever the trails are open. In addition to the sleds, they also rent the jackets, the bibs, the boots, heated helmets, everything that you need so that you are going to be warm and comfortable while you're enjoying the trails.
And Tom mentioned that there's some really good restaurants. Any places you'd recommend for people to check out to grab a drink or a meal?
Absolutely. So a couple of good options. If you want to sip on some great craft beer and hear the local tales of the area, you're going to want to go to Tribute Brewing Company. It's a really cozy spot in Eagle River, and their beers pay homage to the local legends, landmarks, and folk tales of the area, like the Barefoot Charlie IPA or the award-winning Blueberry Train Wheat Ale. So that's a really great stop. I also recommend putting Leafs Cafe on your itinerary for that comfort food that just pairs perfectly with the cold weather. They serve hearty dishes for breakfast and lunch. You're going to find a wide selection of omelets, and they are famous for their chicken and dumplings. So make sure that you save room for that too.
And if people want to enjoy the full 4-day derby and need to find a place to stay, where are some places they could look?
Wild Eagle Lodge is a really excellent choice, honestly, any time of year when you visit Eagle River. That's a year-round resort, and they have accommodations suitable for couples up to travel parties as large as 25. So definitely, if you've got a big group going, Wild Eagle Lodge is a great place to check out, and you're going to have all the comforts and amenities of home. You've got a full kitchen, living rooms, patios. They also have an indoor swimming pool and hot tub. Another great option to look into is Eagle Waters Resort. They have rooms in their lodge, but they also have cabins and condos to choose from. So you're going to want to book early so you can get one of those cabins with a fireplace for that perfect winter in Wisconsin ambiance. And it's also really convenient dining. They have an on-site Eagle Water Supper Club, and their signature dish is their prime rib, which is served nightly along with all the other classics you're going to find on a great supper club menu.
All right, Tom, there are tons of winter activities people can do, but there's something uniquely Wisconsin about snowmobiling. What do you think draws people to the snowmobile derby each winter?
It's enjoyable to watch these people come, have fun, enjoy. Those that have indoor seating, fine. But there's also a large contingency that stand on the side hill in the winter, all bundled up and watch the races, cheer, holler, and yell, and they have a great time. It's a big social tourism gathering coming to the derby track. Much like coming to any other big national event, it's a social gathering here at Eagle River.
And Amanda, same question for you.
Well, snowmobiling is really more than just a pastime in Wisconsin. It's a passion. I think you can hear that in all of the examples that Tom gives about the spirit and the social activity around this derby event. And the heritage of snowmobiling is so strong here too, from that amazing story of the invention of the motor toboggan that started it all, to the 25,000 miles of trails that we have today. There are generations of families and friends that are making memories and making snowmobiling the cornerstone of these unforgettable winter vacations. And you can see all that heritage, that passion. It comes alive during the Derby. It's this great opportunity to be cheering along with tens of thousands of fans and celebrating, you know, this common passion for snowmobiling that unites everyone.
All right. Amanda and Tom, thank you both for joining me for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for having us. Appreciate the time.
Tom Anderson is the CEO of the World Championship Derby Complex in Eagle River, Wisconsin. Amanda Weibel is the Communications Officer for Travel Wisconsin. They both joined Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen for a monthly series, Wandering Wisconsin. You can check out our past episodes at WUWM.com or find it as a podcast. The Snowmobile Derby in Eagle River starts January 16th with the main event on Sunday, January 19th. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayon Silver, Susan Bentz, and Eddie Morales from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Every year, the Wisconsin Policy Forum publishes research on issues impacting Wisconsin citizens. Join us on Monday at noon to learn about some of their top findings in 2024 about the rising cost of housing, where Wisconsin ranks on taxes, and much more. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.